it is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Welcome to Metaphysical Milkshake, the show where we go deep, we get weird, and we search for the meaning of life along the way, presented by Cass Media and Soul Pancake. Hey folks, welcome to Metaphysical Milkshake. I am your co-host, Reza Aslan.
And I am your main host, Rain Wilson. Nice to see you. Thanks for tuning in.
Yes, yes, thank you. Thank you for letting me be the Robin to your Batman, by the way, all these years.
I know you've got tights on down there.
I got like really, really tiny around my ball sack area. How's everything going, Rain? I feel like I haven't seen you in a while. What's going on? What are you working on?
Well,
right
you
now?
Know, I've been traveling around the world with this happiness show. Mm-hmm.
Has it made you any happier?
No, it hasn't. It sucks.
Well, not yet.
I've been to 4 countries already exploring happiness, and I've learned a ton, and it has not affected my daily life. Oh, dear Lord.
I get it. I understand that.
Dear Lord. It's so frustrating. But I'm also, my head has just been in this book. Soul Boom, which comes out in April. So just really hankering down on that. And my head is in that. And I haven't had much space for anything else.
Gotta you know remember what that was
you
like.
Finished your book. You
yeah,
finished your book.
I'm so glad.
Hound of the
done.
Baskervilles.
Hound of Baskerville, that's right. No, it is not. No, it is.
What's it called again?
It's called An American Martyr in Persia. And it's about a kid named Howard Baskerville, but it has nothing to do with the hound, although who knows, maybe he had a dog. I don't know. We're in different places. You're still finishing it up, and I'm like getting ready for the, you know, this book tour and getting ready to go out into the world. You know, I'm in sell mode and you're still in create mode. I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm in create and finish within the next 6 weeks mode. or else.
Or else mode. Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's, you gotta sell some books. This
I gotta
is
go
a tough
sell,
sell.
Some books,
like,
man.
I gotta sell some sociology history examination of Iranian turn of the century shenanigans. That's,
no, it is a
I
it is a
wait.
Thrilling it is a thrilling action-packed book about a young man who is transformed by his experience of the world and
transforms a country. Doesn't he transform?
Yeah, he gives his life to a cause.
This is never going to sell. You need a viral moment. Remember that big moment you had around your Jesus book where you were on Fox News and they're like,
oh,
why would you, a Muslim, write about Jesus?
Oh my God, how can I get Fox News to be mad at me?
You dug in just so expertly with calm, just dissected their argument and it went totally viral. Hundreds of millions of views. You need to go on Fox and get another viral moment.
Well, listen, I gotta. I'm not saying no. Yes, I would. I will gladly. In fact, if there are any producers from Fox News listening in this podcast, I am totally available to come on your network and lambast any one of your anchors. Just pick one. maybe Steve Doocy. He seems like the biggest idiot of them all. But. Any one of them will do. But I will say, look, it's a double-edged sword, my friend, going viral in that way, because obviously there's a lot of benefits to it. People hear about your ideas and your thoughts, and it starts all these conversations. But very quickly what happens is that it takes on this life of its own, and it becomes, you know, very quickly no longer about you and about sort of what, you know, you did or what you said means about the world. And then everyone just kind of takes it in their own direction. And as positive it was for me, the sort of handful of times that I've gone viral for one reason or another, there's a lot that goes wrong. There's a lot of hatred and anger and threats, which is why I didn't want you to tell everybody where I lived, but thanks for that. And, you know, it's a reminder that good ideas and bad ideas spread with the same sort of viral force. If anything, I would say bad ideas spread even more forcefully than good ideas do. So the question becomes, how do you spread a good idea? Like how if you have a movement, something that's important to you, something that really—
Yeah, because I was going to say, even more than an idea, how do you spread actions that are behind that idea? How do you spread a social movement? How do you take that good idea and transform it into something that moves the needle forward?
Well, I've got a possible idea about how to learn to do that. How about from our friend Ruha Benjamin?
Ruha Benjamin.
Ruha is a professor at Princeton. La-di-da.
Fancy. She's
fancy.
Got a master's and a PhD in sociology from Cal Berkeley. Born in India. I love her stories of her background that are in this book. Born in India, but then grew up in South Central LA, part Black, part Persian Indian.
Heyo. and has you know, teaches on a whole host of topics about racism, structural racism, about sort of Black bodies, social anatomy, you know, things like that.
Her last book was fascinating. It was on race and technology and kind of the racism that's inherent in technological progress.
Won a ton of awards, and is just an all-around incredible thinker and speaker, but she's got this new book out called Viral Justice, How We Grow the World That We Want, that we're going to talk a lot about. But, you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to have her on this show was, you know, you and I have talked about this before. The world's on fire. It's really hard to kind of look around and realize so much is going wrong and you want to do something about it. The question is how? How can we as individuals do something about it? How do you build a movement?
Ruha Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been trying to get you on the milkshake for 2 years, at least 3 years, something like that.
I know, but I'm vegan. So, you know, I was like, this milkshake, metaphysical, I don't know.
You can use oat milk. We're fine with oat milk.
Totally fine.
I'm not really vegan, just so you know.
So excited to talk to you about this masterpiece, Viral Justice.
And what a beautiful book, too. I love the cover. Like, it's such a pretty cover.
What's the story of this artwork again? I think you told me, or I read something about it. What's the story?
Yeah, so the artist, he was commissioned by the press, by Princeton University Press. And so it went through different iterations, but we really just wanted to inspire this idea of growth and of individuals taking part in seeding a new world. And so we love that.
It's so pretty. People don't realize that, like, authors have almost no say in their covers at all.
Just luck out.
It's just luck. You know.
Well, speaking of design elements, I was looking through your book this morning and preparation, and because both Reza and I have book. Reza's got a book coming out in October. I've got one coming out in April. All these design decisions. Please just tell us about the Siamese crocodiles.
Right. And so it's the symbol that I use instead of an asterisk, instead of just a space. As a provocation, a kind of chorus throughout the book of these Siamese crocodiles that share a stomach and yet fight over food. And so it grows out of this West African proverb that is speaking to both our interconnectedness as humans and as kind of life on the planet, even beyond humans, but also our foolishness that we continue to fight. We have this scarcity mindset. And yet we're interconnected. We share a stomach. And so it's just kind of like that refrain throughout the book that speaks to me.
I love that your vision, your mission with this story can be boiled down even in the asterisks that you use in between chapters and headings. It's just fantastic. But I spoke about you a little bit before we got started. What an incredible and dynamic, powerful speaker you are. The way you make kind of social justice activism funny, accessible, and also just a continuous gut punch. But what brought you to this book? What led to the writing of it? And I read a little bit about how connected this book is to COVID, to the political unrest of the last couple of years, to kind of a lot of the race movements that happened post George Floyd and many other victims of racism during this time. But why this book now, and what led you to it?
Yeah, it is a book of the moment. It's what we could call it, a pandemic book. It really comes down to trying to write something that I needed at the time, And so, you know, in some ways, it was like my form of therapy in terms of digesting and processing mm-hmm. all of the headlines and all of the currents and crises that we were all experiencing over the last few years. And yet it has this kind of longer genealogy, too, because I'm really drawing on a lot of life experiences, things with my family that I've never really thought like deeply about and processed and connected to my work. And so it was this opportunity to kind of speak to the moment, but also zoom out and think about what all of these experiences, how they're connected and how they connect to a larger story, not just my story, but our story as a humanity. And so, you know, the original title was Viral Racism, because I was thinking about the pandemic and policing. And I remembered what a mentor of mine once said was that we spend so much time naming and conceptualizing what's ailing us, the things that we don't want. And we don't carve out enough intellectual space naming and talking about the world we do want. And so that sort of echoed in my head and was part of my shift from not only the title Viral Racism to Viral Justice, but also giving enough space in the text for all of the examples of people building a world in the small print, in nitty gritty ways that often don't get the attention. So in a lot of ways, this is also a love letter to people who've been doing the work, the kind of invisible labor that doesn't often get a big headline or hashtag or fancy award or grant or what have you.
I have so many positive things to say about the book. I could go on and on. I don't want to do that right now, but I want to say that I really responded to that shift that you made, you know, the world that we do want. You know, it's interesting as I'm going to talk a little bit more about my privilege later on, but in reading some, you know, books over the last couple of years around race and racism, it's always like, oh, you think you understand racism? Wait a second. You have no idea. There's this whole other layer of the onion you hadn't even thought about. And you have done that in the past in some of your writings about race and technology and, you know, some really mind-blowing ideas that would never come to my mind. So this whole idea that you're focusing on almost micro solutions is just fantastic. In the introduction, we're both members of the Baha'i Faith. And in the introduction, you talk about the founder of the Baha'i Faith, Baha'u'llah's vision of justice. And Baha'u'llah says, of course, the best beloved of all things is justice. Turn not away therefrom if thou desirest me or if thou desirest God. How did this spiritual vision of justice influence the roots of this work?
In a lot of ways, it balanced out my training. So this focus in that quotation that's in the book that you just excerpted there is inviting us to look inward, to think about what justice means for us internally, a kind of reflective practice, seeing with our own eyes and not through the eyes of others, knowing with our own knowledge and not the knowledge of our neighbor. So it's encouraging a kind of internal exploration that balances out, I won't say a contrast, but balances out my training as a sociologist, which is trying to focus on these larger processes that are often invisible that shape people's lives. So we have all of this language, right? Structural racism, institutional inequity, huge processes that are important to shine a light on because many people only think about things at an individual level. But as I explain in the book, I kind of went to the other extreme, that kind of indoctrination of my training, and discounted the role of individuals, discounted the role that we each play in terms of individual volition, in terms of social change. And so these two things are really complementary because at the end of the day, you know, people make up institutions, you know, human beings make up societies, we create cultures, you know, these aren't things that operate outside of us. And so I think in many ways, our language can be limiting, like even when we talk about, is it macro or micro? Like, that's a kind of false choice. I think we have to develop a new vocabulary that it recognizes the idea of our interdependence, not even just other human beings, but ecological interdependence, like human beings right now in relation to the planet. And so I would say, you know, the choice that we are often presented, you either look at laws and policies, or you look at individual action and volition, that's a kind of false choice. We have to do both and.
And now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Folks, I may look like an outrageously handsome and wildly successful podcast host.
All true.
And actor and writer. But I still got problems.
No.
You know, I got 99 problems and a podcast ain't one of them. You know what I mean? So I use therapy to help me through my problems on a weekly and on a monthly basis. It helps me focus on the right things and stay out of behavior patterns that can be, well, negative, destructive, and set me back. So it can be really hard to train your brain to stay in problem-solving mode when faced with a challenge, but you learn how to find your own solutions. And then when you do that, there really is no better feeling. And a therapist, my therapist, he helps me learn how to be a better problem solver and helps me learn how to accomplish my goals, no matter how big or how small. So BetterHelp Online Therapy, it's got so many options. You can do video therapy. You can do phone therapy. You can just even do chat therapy. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's way more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours.
Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/milkshake. That's betterhelp.com/milkshake. And listen, folks, you got to take care of yourself. You can't just keep pretending that you can handle it all on your own. You need help. Mm. Just admit it. Call BetterHelp.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void. We're prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You said that the book was originally titled Viral Racism. And now, of course, it's called Viral Justice. But this word, this idea of a thing that's viral is a word that you reference a lot in the book. You talk about kind of things that we can learn from viruses and the spread of viruses. What does the word actually mean to you, and how is it applied when it comes to something like justice?
Yeah, to me, I'm using virality as a lens to train our attention to the microscopic, to things that are often seemingly small. And when we do that and we think specifically about the coronavirus, we realize, oh, this thing that we can't see that is small can bring the planet to its knees, can turn things upside down. And so if something microscopic can do that in the negative sense, how can we think about life-affirming processes, things that are sustaining, things we want more of, not just the things we're trying to eradicate? And so it's a kind of lens to train our attention, to respect, to create more of those things that, again, seemingly small but powerful actions, habits, dispositions, ways of thinking and being in the world that can have exponential effects in ways that can be positive, ways that we can actually engender life, not eradicate it.
I don't know why, but it's easier for me to think about how something negative can spread like a virus because fear, xenophobia, you know, these are bigotry. These are almost evolutionary impulses. And so they can be turned on very easily. And so, and they can spread very easily. I mean, all you have to do is watch any episode of The Twilight Zone. And you see what I'm talking about. There's always that one, you know, moment in which like fear starts to spread like a virus or whatever. But what needs to happen for something positive to spread in that same way, you know? Because it just feels so much more difficult, right, to get people to have a virality when it comes to something good and positive and meaningful, something that affects good, meaningful change.
Totally. And I think, you know, where I start with that is to think about what has inspired me in the past. That's why so much of the book is also kind of excavating those experiences that, you know, had a, you know, were generative for me, that inspired me. And so when we start to pay attention to what gets us going, what we are paying attention to, we see that sometimes it can be very small, fleeting words that someone says, a look that you get, a feeling that's engendered in it through an interaction. And so part of it is that what looms large in our head is often the negative, the fear, you know, the things that bring us to our knees. But once we begin to kind of like, you know, go over those pathways in our own mind and heart about what it has been encouraging to us, what has kept us going, what has made us more courageous, what has made us love, what has made us forgive, like all of those things, then the more that we sort of go on those pathways, we grow that potential. And so part of this book is an invitation for us, again, to take charge of our own minds and mm-hmm. not be, you know, not have our attention directed by all of the different forms of media and experiences that thrive on us being fearful and hateful, et cetera. And so I definitely agree with you that things often do seem to loom large that are destructive, but I don't think that's inevitable. I think mm-hmm. that we can control our own attention, our own minds, and then that therefore, like I quote my grandma in the book, we need to water what we want to grow. You know, we need to actually invest in that.
So this book is just chock-a-block. Have you counted the number of examples that you give in this book of viral justice? Because it's just when you think you've read like the 87th, then it's 89th, and it's 174. It's incredible the number of examples that you give. And for our listeners, can you give us some of your favorite examples? I mean, there's so many. It's as from like Uber drivers sharing the fact that the rides are getting more expensive and they're actually getting paid the same or less, just sharing that on a Facebook group. Yep, you know, viral justice can start as small as that. It can certainly start with someone just seeing a need and beginning a nonprofit or a community activation around some injustice that they see on a local scale. But I'd love to hear, after writing 189 examples of viral justice, what are two or three or four of the ones that really resonate the most with you that you think our listeners would really get off on?
And what can we learn from them? I think that's the other thing too. Like, what can the rest of us learn?
Yeah, there's so many examples. It's like choosing which baby I love more. So let's see. I love a lot the examples in which everyday people almost take the tools that are being used against them and wield it in the other direction. You mentioned like Uber drivers or like, you know, people whose work is being governed by algorithms who then decide, you know what, we can figure out our own coding and programming and flip the script and look at the way that, you know, the people who are governing our work are mistreating us. So I love those examples of taking the same tools and using it to their own ends, to more liberatory ends against oppressive structures, whether it's in the context of Amazon, which mm-hmm. comes up a lot, or in other sort of gig economy work. I think, you know, what really hits home, though, is a lot of the examples that are people and organizations in my own life that don't even know they're in the book yet, that are going to find out in a month and a half, like, whoa, I didn't even know that that hit you like that, you know? And I think part of, you know, this being a love letter is to say that all of these ways that people have touched me and made a way for my family and enveloped me in community that I never perhaps publicly acknowledged, like, this is also my love letter for those individuals and those groups. And so I kind of have a special place for that. I guess the last sort of category of example, though, are movements and collectives that are completely changing the terms of engagement in terms of what they're seeking in the world. And so in the chapter called Hunted, which has to do with police violence and was the hardest to write in terms of my own, you know, personal, my family's experience with policing and incarceration, where there are organizations that are saying, we're not just trying to make this system less harmful. We're not trying to just reduce the number of people beaten or caged and make things a little more tolerable. They're completely questioning, why does this thing exist and what can we create other than this? And so those efforts to essentially pull the rug out and say, we refuse the choice between harmful and most harmful. You know what I mean? And say, forget that. We're going to put on the table a third choice, a fourth choice, a fifth alternative, and not just dream about it, not just kind of like write Twitter posts about it. We're actually going to start creating the relationships in our own backyard that have to do with engendering true safety, true well-being, and how we treat one another. We're not waiting for this pie in the sky to float down. We're going to start living the world that we want in the future right now. And so I feel like that category of examples that run throughout the book really get my blood going. They're, for me, the most galvanizing because they question everything, but don't stay at the level of questioning. They begin to actually work in the dirt to try to create that world.
That's great. And we want to get into that more and how people do that and how listeners can do that and how this viral justice book can virally spawn a viral justice movement. Because I agree with you. Like, one of the things I just hate about social media, and I try and stay off of it as much as possible and took it off my phone, is, you know, you tweet an injustice and it gets retweeted and there's protests and screams. Look, there was an injustice just the other day. There was police beating up a guy who happened to be, I think he was white, but they were just like pounding the shit out of this guy on the sidewalk for no reason whatsoever. They could have just put handcuffs on him. It was just preposterous, which shows, you know, how grotesquely violent our law enforcement system perceives itself as something that needs to subjugate, you know, the communities it's supposed to serve. But we placate ourselves with like, oh, I retweeted this and I said, look how awful this is. And then you feel done. You're a keyboard warrior and you just feel, you feel finished when you're exactly right. There are systems in place that are essentially corrupt and need to be rethought from the ground up.
And one of the, I think, unintended consequences of inundating ourselves with those kind of images and sort of letting those go viral is that it inures us. Our tolerance for seeing and expecting that, whether we want to or not, is also increasing. Like, give it a few years and that video is not going to seem as outrageous because we will have seen 200 since.
Sure, absolutely.
And so, you know, part of it is, what do we want our media, you know, diet to consist of? And we need, for some people who are oblivious or who are, you know, stubbornly ignorant about these things, perhaps it does them some good to bear witness to the harms that are there. But for many people who are living it, we don't need to see it. You know what I mean? And so the question is, what are we actually working towards that can not just reduce, but transform that status quo?
One of the topics you go into a lot in the book is healthcare and especially birth and birthing of Black women communities, something Reza and I don't know anything about, but I'll give you a little glimpse. So I'm literally the most privileged person.
Something we're more than happy to talk about.
Yes, I mean, I'm going to mansplain exactly how this works. So for me, you know, I'm the most privileged guy on the planet. I'm tall, white, middle-aged, wealthy, TV celebrity. I mean, I check every single box. And I had just a little soupçon, a little aperitif of this when my wife had had to get an emergency C-section. And instead of going down to St. Joseph's Medical Center in Santa Monica, which is a glistening medical center, we were whisked away at 3 a.m. and she almost died and my son almost died because she was given just the worst possible care and on a gurney in a hallway as she's bleeding from her vagina and nurses are doing like Excel spreadsheets on their computers. And literally at one point the nurse goes, I can't find the heartbeat. Just says it like that. Like, here, you take the paddles. You know where the baby is. You can find the heartbeat. Oh my God. To me. Just absurd. Anyways, I could go on and on. But got a little bit of a taste of a tiniest whiff of the injustices of the healthcare system. You talk a lot about your own story about being Black and pregnant while at Spelman. You talk about so many examples of Black women giving birth, healthcare inequities, doulas, and the support communities that have arisen around this and the systemic injustices around the healthcare system as affects Black women and birthing. Can you give us the gist of what you're talking about there?
Yes, I can. And so, first of all, I never knew that about what you all had gone through, and it's terrible. And whether you consider it just a small, you know, dimension of this larger problem of reproductive care for any given family, it is traumatizing. And so I just mm-hmm. want to acknowledge that, you know, you kind of live with that trauma of being neglected and being discounted and almost dying. So for me, you know what, and this is one of those places in the book where I was completely spared that experience because of, what I attribute it to is that I was enveloped by a completely different model of pregnancy and childbirth that has a long tradition in the South that is led by Black midwives, where in the state of Georgia, even today, community-based midwives who are not licensed as nurses, it's outlawed. It's not within the law to practice. So my birth at home with a Black midwife was, you know, under the radar, so to speak. Usually they don't get harassed unless something bad happens or not sued unless something bad happens. But it's very rare, you know, for anything, you know. In fact, the kind of risk profile of people who are use Black midwives, our birth outcomes are so much better than our counterparts in hospitals. And it's not, you know, there's a lot of reasons and I explain, but the bigger take home there, again, I had a wonderful experience with Black midwife and her apprentice in my home. But what I really want to offer in that chapter is this approach to childbirth, I think, is a model for how we should approach healthcare more broadly and accompaniment in many other areas of life. You know, so the kind of accompaniment, the art of encouragement, the art of support and holding space for people when they're most vulnerable, I think that applies not just in the context of childbirth. It applies in so many critical junctures in our lives. And so I want to essentially say Black midwives are our role model for how to seed a different world. And they're doing it like one birth at a time. Mm. And again, it's not simply about having fewer C-sections or having a slightly better rate, like this kind of incremental change, because even when you isolate white women in terms of their well-being in the U.S., the outcomes are worse than a long list of other countries, not just industrialized countries, in countries that have far fewer resources. So if you just treat white women as a country, their outcomes are really poor, even though we spend more than any other country on a high tech, healthcare and medicine. So that itself should be a horn for us to wake up and think it's not just about getting the, like, if Black women were having the same outcomes as white women, like having racial equity, that would still be bad. You know what I mean? So it's not simply racial equity, but it's social transformation. Because I don't, like King said, I don't want to be integrated into a burning house. And I think that applies in the context of reproductive care as much as anything else.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, whether it is about healthcare, reproductive care, racism, or income equality, or climate, you know, it just sometimes feels like these issues are so huge and so overwhelming that, and especially when you look at them, you know, on a global stage, they just seem unfixable. It's very hard not to look at some of these systemic problems and to feel discouraged and to throw your hands up and to just be like, you know what, there's nothing I can do about it. There's no changing the world. And so I've given up. And I think the thing that's so encouraging and inspiring about your book, and so much a part of sort of the larger topic that we want to talk about today, which is, you know, how to start a movement, is that you really do talk about tackling these issues in sort of smaller ways, like starting, you know, with the individual and with the community, and to not get overwhelmed by the bigness of these problems. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that process actually looks like? You know, and we can talk about racism, we can talk about income inequality if you want. Those are the two things that you mostly deal with in the book. But really, any problem, you know, how does an individual think to themselves, okay, I'm going to start small, I'm going to start with myself, I'm going to start with my community, I'm going to start with my city, whatever the case may be, and then in a viral way, make this thing, you know, global enough to actually make a difference in the world?
Absolutely.
That might be too big of a question, but
no, it's the $1 million question. But I feel like as a you know, the first things is that for anyone listening who's really in that space of it feeling really overwhelming, you know, my own self-talk it involves quoting to myself the words of the late great Jimmy Baldwin, who said, I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. Mm. And so for me, that says that there's already a privilege in throwing our hands up, in saying, oh, I can't, you know, there's too much. Because if you're in the trenches, if these forces are affecting your ability to feed yourself or your family, or to educate yourself, or to get life-saving treatment, or to avoid the deadly force of the police, or to get a job, like these fundamental goods that people need to thrive, then you almost don't have the luxury to be like, F it, you know, yeah. It's too big. Because what's too big to one person who has the luxury to sit back and kind of, you know, take it all in is you trying to grind day in and day out. And so that's why I think in the aftermath of the pandemic, when we saw the proliferation of all of these mutual aid groups, on the one hand, you know, it brought people into the process of mutual aid who before, you know, didn't really have to rely on their neighbors, didn't really have to think about what was lacking in their neighborhood. And so it was a moment of more people getting in the trenches. And so what does that look like when we're not in crisis mode? You know, I use this term in throughout the book, about plotting, like we're plotting a different world. And I'm thinking about that at different levels. I'm thinking about, you know, I was a drama major when I first started college. And so I'm always
know that about you.
Yes, we'll geek out. So before, to me, there's so much synergy between drama and sociology. And sociology rips off theater all the time in our language when we talk about, you know, social narratives and social roles and the front stage and the backstage. Like, we're always ripping off theater. But the fact of the matter is, like, when we think about these narratives, these plots, like these narrative plots that we've inherited, these scripts that we follow, a first step in world building and movement building is questioning these inherited plots, questioning these roles we've been assigned, you know, in fact, tearing up the scripts and thinking about how do we become protagonists in a different kind of process, right? Rather than simply abiding by these scripts we've inherited. So that's one idea of plotting, right? The other that I'm thinking about is literally like the idea of getting our hands dirty in our own backyards, plot, like figuring out what the plot is in terms of, you know, I use a lot of examples of gardening in the book. In LA, there's someone called the gangster gardener who has taken the areas on the sidewalks in front of their yards and created these edible gardens, right? And so how we use that as a metaphor, and I want readers to think about what their plot is, right? And really to, I want us to respect all of the different ways that people can get involved, right? The last line of the book is that we have to respect the loud and ferocious world builders as much as the quiet and studious ones, that we all have a role to play. And for me, it makes perfect sense because we got here to this crossroads of multiple crises through many different angles, top-down policies and laws, sideways cultural norms, everyday bottom-up actions. Like, the oppressive status quo was created through all of these pathways, which means all of these pathways are ways for people to get involved. And so I want listeners to think about what gets their blood boiling, what keeps you up at night, what pisses you off. Like, what pisses me off is such a motivator and a fuel. Like, you know, my hands will be banging on the keys of the keyboard because I'll be so angry about something. That's a good sign, you know, to think about what pisses you off. And then crucially, to look around and look at who is already working on that front, rather than trying to be a lone savior or hero or create a new app for this or a new business venture that deals with whatever problem you've discovered. You know, getting out of that entrepreneurial mindset and getting into a collaborative posture and thinking about how you can put your skills and energy to the service of organizations that have probably been working on that front for longer than you've been alive. And so to me, it's crucial to tap into what you're passionate about, but not to be ruled by passion, to actually learn from the organizations, the communities, the movements around you and work in solidarity with them.
I love that. That's so important. And I think I was talking to a friend who came from Australia, who moved here from Australia recently, and in Australia, he was talking about, like, it has a lot of collectivism. The Americans have such an entrepreneurial bent on everything. Like, everything is about the individual and the sanctity of the individual and the power of the individual. And so I guess really what we're asking when we're talking about starting a viral justice movement is we're talking about the individual working in conjunction and in cooperation and in collectivism for that change. And we have to kind of set aside our American kind of like gung-ho cowboy way of doing things. I'm thinking about, however, someone I got to know a little bit was Greta Thunberg. And just that, and that's when I share, you know, around this topic with young people at college campuses, I always talk about Greta because it's so doable. It's like, here's a girl on the spectrum. She read an article about climate change. She's like, why is no one, wait a minute, that we're killing the earth? No one's sitting around and just having coffee and going about their lives. And every Friday, she just made a dumb little sign and sat out there and then eventually got interviewed. And then the interview spread and then it really went viral. And she has hundreds of millions of followers. And you know, have we fixed climate change? No, but has she made a dent? Has she moved the needle, especially with young people? Absolutely. And I love that you quote an activist from Philadelphia named Stephanie Keen. And when people ask Stephanie Keen, what should we do, especially privileged folks, like what should we do to help? And she says, do what you're good at. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so it's this, you know, this marriage of passion and skill. And, you know, she talks about if you like to cook, you know, she says revolutionaries need to eat. If you're good at data, we need the nerds, you know, if you're in the arts, like every movement has to be revitalized through music, through song and storytelling. Like that's not icing an extra on the cake. It's the heartbeat of any movement worth its salt. And so when we begin to actually expand our imagination of what it will take, then it engenders a deep respect of what everyone brings to the table. You know, like you can't do it without the data nerds or the, you know, the airy, you know, like musicians or the, you know, like not everyone needs to be good at the same thing. Keen says, like that's not what makes a movement. And so we have to carve out space for us to, you know, not just bring our different capacities and skills, but to really respect what people are bringing to the table and also to leave room for conflict and consultation and debate. You know, it's not all, you know, kumbaya, but I think what essentially through our kind of, again, a media saturation of a particular poster child of activism, a particular kind of image of what a advocate looks like or sounds like, dresses like, you know, what lingo they use, you know, what buzzwords, it narrows the scope and it actually becomes the veneer of something rather than, you know, the substance of what we need to work on.
You know, one thing that's kind of difficult when it comes to building movements is you have to create some kind of shared identity amongst a diverse group of individuals, right? I was thinking about this interview that Andrew Yang, who anybody who follows me on social media knows I am not a fan of. On the contrary, I just think he is an unserious joke. But, you know, he's got this party now called the Forward Party. And it's supposed to be neither right nor left. It's all of us. And our ideas are neither liberal nor conservative. They're forward. And so he did this interview that kind of went a little bit viral in which an anchor asked him, okay, but like you have to have positions, right? Like, so for instance, what is your party's position on abortion? And he's like, you know, we don't have a left position or a right position. We have a forward position. And the anchor does not have the ability to say, what the fuck are you talking about, asshole, like I do? But it occurred to me that, you know, from that interview, one of the most difficult problems with creating social movements is, and even those, you know, focused on things like justice or income equality, is that on the one hand, your strength comes from drawing people from all over the place, right? The whole political spectrum, different races, different, you know, social classes, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, you have to figure out a way to get everybody to kind of accept a singular idea, a singular narrative, a singular movement, you know, something that you can all just kind of use as a means of identity. Could you talk a little bit about how do we create something that is meaningful and has the ability to draw a large audience, is diverse, but still at the same time is uncompromising in the values that it is putting forth?
I think that distinction is important, that the kind of diversity of dispositions and skills and capacities I referred to earlier has more to do with the how of how we do things, not the what, the kind of uncompromising what. What are the principles on which any movement is built? And I think one place to start is really thinking about what tradition are we building on? When we are working to foster any kind of social change or movement, we're not starting from scratch. We're not, you know, again, it's not this entrepreneurial mindset, always trying to be original. We're thinking about what, whose shoulders do we stand on? What tradition are we building on? And so if we're talking about the long freedom struggle in this country, then there are a set of principles around justice, around equity that are uncompromising. And there are also pragmatic ideas about how we do that, right? In terms of what kind of economic system, what kind of political system, educational system do we need? And so I think we need to distinguish between really having open arms in terms of how we work together and what we bring to the table, with understanding that there's a set of principles around, you know, the distribution of goods and resources and respect that allows everyone to live a flourishing life. And not all economic systems will get us there. Not all political systems will get us there to ensure that everyone has what they need to live a flourishing life. And so I think it's a something also that requires ongoing sort of calibration. Like, we don't just decide at one point in time, these are the principles we stand for. This is how we get there. We have to also constantly be checking if we're adhering to those noble principles and those ideas. And so it's a kind of ongoing exercise in humility and self-reflection that has to happen at a collective level as well.
Ruha, this book is fantastic. And I really thank you too for sharing your personal story so much throughout it. I was very moved by those anecdotes and a lot of the suffering that you've undergone personally along this path. And in a book published by Princeton University Press, that's a pretty rare thing to kind of have some personal, this is peer reviewed, I understand, probably.
Yeah.
but to have stories of your family life, working life, your growing up life, your struggles is super important. And it's an exciting book. And I just wish you the very best in
Thanks.
Promoting it, launching it. And may it launch another 10,000 instances
you.
Of viral justice around the globe.
Thank you
so much for
me.
Yes, thanks for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. Thank you for Reza. Joining us on the Metaphysical Oat Milkshake.
Thanks, Reza. Thanks, Rain.
So, wow, so much to think about.
Yeah.
Viral movements.
What a speaker. I want to see her speak live. She seems...
Oh, she's dynamic. She's really hard-hitting and dynamic and just all kinds of stories and examples. Not theoretical, you know, really just down in the dirt mm-hmm. of social
Really
change.
Great advice. But, yeah, great advice about how to start movements. And
let me ask you this. What, you know, movements are important. There's a lot that needs changing in the world. It can be overwhelming, like you mm-hmm. said earlier on. What social movement would you start? I mean, if you had an opportunity, Reza, like in your life right
wow,
now, and you were able to kind of
yeah.
start a little virus in your neighborhood of, you know, Highland Park, neighborhood of LA, 5454.
Please don't tell
Mulhaney
people where
Place.
I live. Okay.
I'm sorry.
People who hate me already. But this is a fascinating question. If I could start a movement that would start small, individual, and then have the virality to like take over the globe and to really change things for the good, I guess, I would have a movement about how to use proper grammar. I think that's what I would do. That's a big global problem. You know, if you think about it in a global sense, it becomes a little too heavy, too much, unfixable. But if I start going around annoying the people in my community about the proper difference between your and your, or when to use that and when to use which, then I think I could then use that to create a global movement dedicated to proper grammar. Does that... sound about...
You sound like one of those Twitter grammar police that's always correcting the your and your, you are and your thing.
What about you? Certainly nothing nearly as important or
okay, I'm going to go a step above of grammar. I mean, that is crucial. I think good grammar is one of the most important
thingies.
Topics that we can focus on. One of the greatest needs of humanity moving forward. But I guess... for me, similarly, I always think this when I'm driving. I'm always thinking like, if there's a big long line of cars on the 101 merging into the 405 into LA, and you don't wait in that line, and you go in the left lane and you kind of cut around, and then you duck in at the last minute. So you're cutting in line, just
you're
like you
asshole,
would cut in line at a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
If that is still happening, how are we ever going to affect true social change? Because you're putting yourself ahead of the collective. So I believe that social transformation begins on the freeways. It begins on the highways. It begins at the stop signs.
It's a good one.
It begins at the red lights and at the yield signs, where we all need to drive with great compassion. And we need to drive as if the golden rule is powering our engine. Also, don't pass in the fucking right lane. Don't pass in the right lane. Don't do it.
An entire movement dedicated to not passing on the right lane. I think that has the potential for global transformation. I really do.
Yeah.
What about you, dear listener? Do you have an idea for a movement? It could be a small movement, global movement. Let us know. You can find us on social media at Reza Aslan and at Rainn Wilson, and on Twitter at MetaMilk Podcast. We're on Instagram at Metaphysical Milkshake. Let us know what your social movement would be, and if you have any sort of big life questions too, we'd love to hear those. Actually, here's something cool. We are giving away 5 copies of Ruha's book, Viral Justice. So it's great because it'll give you a ton of ideas about how to actually affect global change. All you got to do, it's very easy. You got to write a review for Metaphysical Milkshake on Apple Podcasts. It doesn't have to be a positive review, but if it's a negative review, we might accidentally lose your email. But all you got to do is email a screenshot of it to metaphysical@castmedia. That's cast with a K, media.com, metaphysical@castmedia.com. First 5 people who do it will get a copy of the book. Please, no P.O. boxes, and please only U.S. residents, because we just can't afford to send it to Peru. We just can't.
We just can't do it. We don't have the budget.
You don't know how little money podcasts make, my friend.
You can also subscribe to Metaphysical Milkshake on our YouTube channel and watch us having these scintillating conversations. Watch full episodes each week. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much for tuning in, Milkshakers. We love you.
See you next week.
Metaphysical Milkshake is executive produced by Rainn Wilson, Reza Aslan, and Colin Thompson. It is produced by Safa Samazadeh Yazd, Paris Lane, Mick Demaria, Hashem Self, and DJ Lubel. Cast Media is the production and distribution partner. Original music by Jeff Tang.
I'm always thinking about that, but I don't actually write it. I'm always thinking to myself, like, you mean your?
It's so rife with judgment.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.